Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, buddy. Welcome to the post-Thanksgiving edition of Food Talk with Mike Colomeco. Mike Colomeco here, your host. Hey, how you doing out there? Radio, internet, streaming world. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I had a good one. Took it home quiet, just me, the family. One of those great heritage birds from Frank Reese. Some good side dishes, a little early. I always hate that. Like 5 o'clock. My kids want to eat at 4, so we ate at 5, but that's still too early for me. But anyway, welcome back. I took the week off. I think everybody did. I think we were shut down for Thanksgiving Day. But we're back live. Great to be here. Got a great show. We got jam-packed with guests today. My first guest will be on in a couple of minutes, Gabriella Gershenson. You may remember her. She was the dining out editor for the entire dining section, food section of Time Out New York. Then she was at Sever for 3 or 4 years. Now she's at Every Day with Rachel Ray. We're going to talk about this movement of new Jewish cooking taking place in cities, in New York specifically. Then I've got Chef Saul Bolton, who's had a restaurant here in Brooklyn. He's really one of the pioneers, called Restaurant Saul. He's a great guy. We'll intro him. He'll be after Gabriella. And then at some point, as we're getting ready to 15, 20 minutes left in the hour, we'll have Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg in, a couple that have been together for a long time, written a lot of books specifically on wine and food pairings. We'll talk about that. So 3 guests, my little folksy intro. Yeah, that's what they say on my Wikipedia page. I have a folksy style. Yeah, whatever. Could be worse, I suppose. I like folk music, you know, alt country, whatever. You can call me folksy. Call me anything you want. So it's Christmas. It's Christmas season. I walked here from the subway stop at Morgan here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, the Morgan stop on the L train. And there's Christmas trees for sale on Bogart Street. Yeah, that's right. You know it's Christmas around Gotham City when there's trees all over the street. The tree at Rock Center is lit. I haven't seen it yet. I always make a point of going past that tree because it is gorgeous. I love that little plaza in New York. I got a great Thanksgiving story. Years back, I used to do a show called Food Talk on WOR. It was a show that had been on the radio for the better part of 2 decades. Arthur Schwartz, Brooklyn native, son of Brooklyn, started that show way back in the early 90s. And we had it for about 10 or 12 years, and Arthur had a falling out with the station, which I completely understand. And then Rocco DeSpirito had it for a while, Tyler Florence for about 6 months, and then me for the last 6 years till I rode it into the sunset. And I found out, my first day on the job was, I think, September 16th of 2006. And around late October, they said, you know, Thanksgiving, you work, right? And I'm like, what? They go, oh, no, it's a huge day. It's a huge day for Food Talk. In fact, you got to come in really early. Like, you're going to do morning drive. And I'm, you're kidding. Why? And they said, well, a lot of people call up with recipes and questions and turkey stuff. So can you be in by 5 a.m.? And I'm like, dude, really? My show's live at 11. How about 6? So they said, okay, come in at 6. But you're going to do morning drive from 6 until 9 with the morning drive team. And one of the morning drive hosts then, the only other host that was on the air with me that day, I think, was Rudy Giuliani, the ex-mayor of New York's ex-wife, Donna Hanover. And Donna was one of these prim and proper types, really sweet girl, drank like, I don't know, some kind of diet soda and brought with her little bags of like carrot sticks and celery sticks and pretzels, and everything was organized. And because it's morning drive, she'd come in early, so she'd be wearing like casual clothes and have her hair up in a bun, because those hosts had to be in by like 3:30, 4 in the morning to get the show ready. Morning drive is huge in AM radio. So anyway, so I'm not a morning guy, so I got to be there at 6. They had a car service picking me up at like 5:15 at my apartment in the Village. And the night before, I swore I was going to be a good boy. I swore. So I made a really early dinner reservation. Shane McBride, who's now the chef at Balthazar, he's a great chef. I've known Shane for years. Shane had his own restaurant at that point in the West 50s, some kind of steak-themed chop house-y restaurant. And I made a 7 o'clock reservation. Met a couple of friends there and said, yeah, I got to be out of here by 10:30, go to bed early. Well, one bottle of wine, 20 courses later, 6 bottles of wine. Then the chef sits down and we do a bourbon tasting. And I took a subway home, and I don't know what time of night it was, 1:30. And I was absolutely wasted. I'm not proud to admit that, but when chefs hang out, it happens. It's like a side effect of chefs hanging out and doing bourbon tastings and just being chefs, and then you stand up and go, holy God, it's 1:30. So I remember getting home at like 2 in that kind of condition when you've been drinking so much, you just kind of like take your clothes off, fall on your bed, and pass out. You just like gonk, you just fall asleep. But you're not really sleeping, are you? You're just sort of recirculating alcohol breath. And my alarm went off at 5 or some ungodly hour, and I just remember like my breath tasted like bourbon, and I'm sure legally, if I had to blow in one of those things, I was way on the other side of sober. I was in horrible shape, but being an old pro, it didn't bother me. And I remember taking the car service down there and walking into that studio with Don Hanover, and I must have reeked like booze. And Don is looking at me with this look on her face. It was like Phil Spector. I had those, you know, those Ray-Ban shades on, and I don't smoke, but I should have had a Marlboro hanging out of my mouth. And I remember doing that show live for 3 hours with her, and it was absolute torture. Went to get myself something to eat after that, and it was a little cemetery, WOR's downtown New York, on Broadway, and it was a little beautiful old cemetery. I remember going out for my 1 hour break and like reading tombstones. So there you go. That's my cheery Thanksgiving story. Next year I was better. Do we have Gabriella on the phone? Do we have Gabriella Gerges on the phone? We don't have her on the phone. All right. So she's, it's maybe a miscommunication here. If not, we'll probably bring in a guest. Let me just ask she's not answering. She's not picking up. Okay. Maybe we'll try a couple times during the show. And if we get her, we get her. Okay, great. Is Saul here? Okay, 1 second here. This is live radio, and we're doing... Okay, no worries. Karen and Andrew are early. Okay, well, Saul just walked in. Saul Bolton's here. All right, so... yes, this is internet radio, folks. This is how we do it. That's right. It's like riding horses here, okay? It's old school. We don't have fancy engineers and receptionists and call screeners. So let's bring in Saul first, because Saul is my first guest here. We'll bring him in and have a conversation. Hey, Karen. Hey, guys, how are you? How are you? Can Saul come in ahead of you?
Sure.
He's here, isn't he?
Yeah.
Did he walk in?
Yeah.
Thanks. Have a seat anywhere you want.
Okay.
Saul, come on in, brother. This is casual radio stuff. The microphone's hot. We are live, so if maybe that microphone, and you don't need headphones because we're not taking calls or anything like that. Good to see you again.
Pizza.
Yeah, have a piece of pizza. Everybody have a piece of pizza. I should announce one of my perks, my agent.
We'll come tomorrow. We'll come tonight.
That's right. It introduced a great contract for me where, on top of the incredible pay that I get, it's free pizza. Yes, at Roberta's. Sometimes I take it home in the Roberta's box, which is the ultimate hipdom. Getting off that L train on 14th with a Roberta's box. Yeah, that's right. Fresh from Bushwick.
New status symbol.
I'll sell it to somebody on 14th Street. Anyway, let's go on with some interviews here. I told my WOR first day Thanksgiving hangover story. So if you want a piece of pizza, help yourself. You might have trouble with it because you might be on microphone. But
I'm all good.
And then you guys are going to be on in like 20 minutes, 15 minutes. So you're just chilling. So just eat and hang out and have fun. So look, my first guest, and pull that mic a little closer to you. It'll sound a little better. The closer you are, the better it sounds.
Okay.
That sounds good. And you could, again, just kind of be right on top of the thing, like the music studios. Saul, you and I met back in 2001, I think.
Ooh-wee, a long time ago on Smith Street.
Long time ago on Smith Street, and I think it was my first full season on PBS, and I'd heard about this Smith Street thing. So all you kids out there that just came to Brooklyn like yesterday and think it was always like this or it was like this a year or two ago, it isn't. So we're going to do a little Brooklyn history here. Brooklyn restaurant history, I'm speaking of. So I'd heard about Smith Street, and I knew about Alan Harding and Patois, and I know he was part of that show. There was 5 or 6 restaurants lined up, and I remember going into all of those kitchens and eating the food, and your kitchen blew me away. I thought you, back then, were the most impressive kitchen in Brooklyn, although there was somebody down the street that had some kind of Zagat rating or Michelin. I was like, what the heck? They were good, but I thought your kitchen was just really disciplined and tight, and your servers got service, and you had sort of had the whole package together. So talk about your background pre-Brooklyn, and then what, obviously it was price and cheap rents, but what drew you to Brooklyn and what drew you to that spot? And give us the context of what it was like back then.
Well, back then I was coming from working for David Boulay at the Old Boulay for about 2 years, and then working for Gilbert Lacoste when he was alive at Le Bernardin, and then helping to open Verbena and Les Zoux, which is now the Spotted Pig in the village. And my wife and I, mostly because we had our first son and we were living on Carmine Street in the city, and we had a 1-bedroom rent stabilized, In retrospect, we should have kept that, but we didn't for $400 a month. You know, we were sort of pushed out economically. And, you know, you mentioned economics being part of the reasons that a lot of chefs have gone out to Brooklyn in the first place and continue to do so. And so we moved out there. So we were there. And after sort of getting a view of the people that live there, the housing stock, the proximity to Manhattan, the rents, which were incredibly cheap at that time, we decided to look for a spot there. I mean, we looked in the city, we looked Brooklyn Heights, Park Slope, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we ended up on Smith Street for a number of reasons. Very happy to be there. And we had a nice long run, 14 years. And time speeds by. And you talk about how tight we were and how we had such nice food now. But look at Brooklyn where it is now. You have Michelin 3-star, Michelin 2-star. You have Blanca here at Roberta's. Amazing food. So the trajectory of Brooklyn cuisine is just amazing. I mean, Brooklyn is the coolest place on planet Earth.
Well,
you know, I'm not claiming to be part of that necessarily, but I'm just saying it's become that, and for good reason.
Yeah, and it has, and it's international too. I mean, I think there's a French expression, "Très Brooklyn," that means like everything cool. Exactly. I remember I was in Poland in September doing. We were filming in Poland, and there was a guy that opened up a little sandwich shop. He's never been to New York, but it was this cool little sandwich. I never met him before, and it was cool and a funky little concept. And I walked in, and of course, you know, he had the hair and the full sleeve, and I said, "Dude, very Brooklyn." And he was like, whoa. Like, that was the highest of praise. So if you're under a certain age, if you're under 35, to be paired with, part of Brooklyn, living in Brooklyn, referred to as Brooklyn-esque, yeah, that's about as high a compliment as it goes. But so you had these serious chops. I remember that. I mean, David Boulay may not be the greatest businessman in the world, but he certainly is a good chef.
He's a great chef.
You can't knock it.
He still is.
He's a chef. Gilbert Lacoste, I think Dominic Cerrone was in that kitchen. Eberhard Mueller was in that kitchen back then.
Yep, that was a touch before my time. Eric Rapert was actually there.
Oh, okay.
After
Gilbert passed.
Yeah,
okay.
He was running the show. Gilbert was still around. They would hang out together on the pass. Gilbert not wearing any underwear in his white pants and his white top with his long hair.
Yeah, I know.
It was a different world back then. The health department would be none too pleased. But he was an amazing guy. And Eric was a very fair man to work for in retrospect. Great kitchen.
And a great kitchen. I mean, that is the longest running 4-star New York Times kitchen uninterrupted since the opening, when it was Mueller and Lacoste in that kitchen. They've had 3 stars since day one and really reinvented fish cookery in America.
Yeah, it was just so incredibly consistent. And coming there from Boulay, where we had 2 or 3 sauces on the plate, and I arrived at Le Bernardin, and the components were 3, 4, maybe, maximum. But it was all about the perfection, cooking the fish perfectly every single time. And I just remember the incredible stress, because we tested everything. Now you see everybody test it with the cake testers. And he had a slightly larger skewer that we had tested, and you'd take the fish to the pass to the almighty Gilbert or Eric, and you'd just turn around, and they would be testing it, and you'd be going back to your station and just praying that it would have the perfect temperature. So, I mean, the consistency, and I've gone back there 3-4 times since then and dined, and every single time. And as working there, it's so simple. You know, chefs always want to be, or young cooks want to be, challenged beyond belief and constant change. Going back there as a diner is just an amazing experience, and you really begin to appreciate what they bring to the table.
It's completely solid. I'm sure you guys will. Now everyone's nodding their head in the studio here. I mean, it's a great kitchen. It's been a solid kitchen. Again, 2 chefs in the entire span of a 30-some-year run, I think, at this point, or damn near 30 years. Uninterrupted 4-star times, 3-star Michelin, deserves it all. And someday I'll talk at length about the opening, as I was sort of involved on the sidelines of that. It was a different city back then. So let's get back to you. So you come to Brooklyn, you're living here, you open up on Smith Street. How was business the early days? Was there a learning curve, a loop? Was it busy, slow? Were you instantly a hit?
Business, well, I mean, I don't think I was ever a hit. Business was good from the very beginning, and it sort of continued to climb, and then the recession, the housing bubble burst, and things sort of crashed, and 9/11 had a big impact also. So I don't think we reached the heights business-wise that we had before the bubble. I mean, the bubble was during the bubble, it was insane. It was insane, the stuff that was going on in our tiny little place. But things were good, and things are good now in our new spot and our other spots that we have. The Vanderbilt, which you visited also.
I did, which is great. That was sort of on Vanderbilt Avenue, kind of an early I mean, you see a lot of this now, this kind of cocktails paired with small plates. And am I misstating what the concept was?
Yeah, we've got the, it's sort of cocktail, large cocktail program.
Yeah, great cocktail program.
American gastropub, sort of riffing off Spotted Pig, making a lot of our own charcuterie, which grew into Brooklyn Bangers, which is our sausage company that we have now. And we were pioneers, too, in Vanderbilt Avenue. And now at least 15 more restaurants have opened since we opened up. And there's some a lot of hot places there, too. Yeah. Great ramen places, Thai places, Japanese, American, on and on. Good coffee.
Who were your contemporaries back then? I mentioned Alan Harding, and I think he was really one of the pioneers. And Alan told me the story, which is a great story, that he, too, was working in Manhattan, had worked in some really good kitchens, wanted to stay in Manhattan, was looking at these leases back then for, I mean, nowadays for Manhattan would be affordable, but, you know, $12,000 or $15,000 a month, and was thinking, I got to sell a lot of chicken, man. I know the, you know, the restaurant, I think people don't realize how hard it is to actually make profits in the restaurant business.
Oh, yeah.
So he was looking at Smith Street, which back then, in 99, 2000, you could have rolled a bowling ball down at night and not hit much. Yeah. A few pigeons and a seagull. It was quiet. Most of the storefronts were blacked out. There wasn't a lot of business. And he found a spot with a kind of a commercial kitchen in the back that was going to work for $1,000 a month. And he thought, shit, if this thing fails, I'll just live in it. I mean, what the hell?
He's the type of guy that would.
I'll have a ground floor apartment with a dope-ass kitchen. Who cares, yeah. Right? The long story short, obviously it hasn't. Alan's done really well. But who else was around back then? What were some of the restaurants in and around where you were? Or
I mean, I don't know if you'll recognize everybody, but of course you had Charlie and Sharon at the Grocery.
The Grocery, which
we
was the one that got
them.
All
of that course.
Was the Daggett 27 and, yeah.
Doing their
three
things.
Three stars,
there
I think,
was Dan Houle, who I worked with at Boulay, who went on to Quilted Giraffe with Barry Wine, and he opened Banania, the Banania Cafe, which is an excellent spot, great corner spot.
I remember
him.
He ran
that for a number of years. And then there was Smith Street Kitchen. And out of that, there are three partners. There's a partner now that is running a fantastic place right off of Franklin Avenue called Franklin Park that's an incredible beer garden. This guy, his name is Anatoly. And he has Cornelius, Franklin Park, and he just opened a whiskey bar, and the name escapes me, but he's still going strong. Other people far away from us, but probably the person I worship more than any of these other great chefs, cooks, business people is Anna Klinger at Aldi La.
Aldi La, and her husband does the dining room, yeah. Park Slope, this beautiful dining room. Oh. He's the crazy guy who's got the crazy hair and
he
is a really
great hair.
Exuberant personality, and she is in that kitchen. Solid, solid kitchen.
She's amazing. Year after year after year, and she has two beautiful kids now. She's a beautiful woman. When I look for advice when I'm down, I go there for lunch, and hopefully she's around, you know, but as I wouldn't dare call her, but she always makes me feel better and sort of sets me straight, so I have a lot of respect for her.
That's nice. Nice to have soulmates in this business you can talk to.
Because I think
people, I always joke with chefs that people come into restaurants when they're busy and think, wow, this must be so much fun. How cool. It's like a party every night, dude. And you get to come out with your customers. You get this big bar. And then you're like, do you have any idea how little money we make? Yeah. If I know more, you know, so many chefs have really successful restaurants. They were single restaurants. And at the end of the day, I know what they're them and their wives, the last people to get paid at the end of the year. It's a struggle. It's a struggle. I remember when I left, I was the executive chef at the Ritz-Carlton, great corporate gig. I was 31 years old back in 1986, making, you know, 100 and change with benefits. And I left that to go open my own restaurant. And I knew what I was getting into, but it was like, I never saw that money again for a long, long time. And I didn't see half of it for a long time. It was just like, get by and build the bridge. So you had the foresight to buy the building on Smith Street at some point, didn't you?
Yes, yes. Yeah, we were lucky. It was in the lease, and we were lucky to be able to buy it. That's sort of retirement. You talk about small businesses not making a big profit, et cetera. And it is a struggle day to day. And it is a mom and pop business. And we do have kids and we do have mortgages. We have all that stuff. So thank God, you know, because what are we taking with us at the end of the day? You talk about the Ritz-Carlton, a corporate gig. I mean, they're major trade-offs, but that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I know.
You're not necessarily thinking about the building when you go home and you're going to sleep.
Right. It's not the compressor's not my problem.
You've got insurance.
The hoods aren't my problem. That's right. Health department, hey, fix that thing. Call maintenance. Stuff breaks.
Absolutely.
I remember when I opened my own restaurant, I left the Ritz to go open my own restaurant. That was the sacrifice I made. And I remember, like, suddenly you just become a jack of all trades. You are the refrigeration guy. You can fix the ice machine. You're up on the roof doing the hoods. Grease trap, I got that down. I was mopping floors. I remember from being an executive chef making 100 and some grand to – you know, the first year, I don't know what the hell we made. You know, next to nothing. And yeah, you'd come in at 7 in the morning and leave at midnight. And I was the guy that was mopping the floors and straining the stock and icing down everything and cleaning out the walk-in box, because that's the way it was. That's the business.
But on the other hand, the sort of satisfaction and the feeling that it is your business, that, yeah, you know, you can be yourself, because, I mean, that's a huge, there is a big trade-off, and there is a great satisfaction to running your own place.
I found that the downside of being an executive chef, and I've talked to more and more people that agree, is especially in that kind of a corporate setting, is that you become much more executive and less chef. You're spending less time and less time doing what you actually dove in this business, what you loved. I mean, I started cooking at 13, 14 as a pot washer, but working my way through junior high and high school. And on my day off, my favorite thing to do is cook. I mean, when I have a night off in New York, I'm not going out. I cook in my, I mean, I love being around food and the process.
Right.
Talk about your new place, because you've moved, and it's interesting. You're now in the Brooklyn, the museum.
We're in the Brooklyn Museum, but I want to rewind just a touch, because last December we opened Red Gravy on Atlantic Avenue, 151 Atlantic Avenue. And that was a wicked, intense experience, and it continues to be so. Amazing people there, amazing food. I love them. And, you know, I had an amazing dinner two nights ago there that I go into the kitchen, and our chef de cuisine, Aisha, who's worked with Lydia and Ed Volce with Missy, et cetera. I go in there, and this is why we do what we do. And she is so incredibly passionate. Even now, you know, you come close to crying. The food is so good.
Mm, that good. Mm. So tell me about the concept of that place.
It's Southern Italian. Yeah. The whole deal was focusing on Calabria, Apulia, which is amazing cuisine and so different. And it's, you're going to say, wow, that's too expensive. There's no way you could possibly ever cover any of this. Which, that's up for argument, but Apulia, Calabria, touch of Basilicata, and Sicily, which is, that's a lifetime.
Hell yeah. And that's a whole bunch of cultures and a whole bunch of crossroads. That's a big palette to paint with.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it's a work in progress. Very, very intense opening. And you can tell that I feel it. But the Brooklyn Museum, now we're there, and I was approached about the Brooklyn Museum, and I drive past it every day. On the way to Saul, the old spot, and it's a beautiful, iconic museum. And Grand Army Plaza, the library has been redone. The museum has an incredible revamping. Also, that part of Brooklyn is popping, you know, and it's connected pretty intimately to Vanderbilt Avenue, the Barclays Center, which we have two stands selling hot dogs there with Brooklyn bangers, it seemed extremely exciting, and it's a very complicated thing, but they're within 12 weeks with a fantastic Brooklyn-based designers, Uhuru, who have pieces in the Smithsonian. They're really furniture makers, but they're incredibly intuitive designers too. And in 12 weeks we turned a large, what used to be the gift shop at the Brooklyn Museum, into a really lovely dining room. Nice. And they had a kitchen that they had never used upstairs.
So I was going to ask about that, because that's the nightmare. How do you fit? Where's the gas? Where's the electric? Where's the hoods? How do you fix? That's huge.
And it's a landmark. It was there.
Sitting there.
It was sitting there unused for a year and a half. And there was a lot of money. We have the nicest exhaust system that you could ever imagine. But the design of the actual kitchen was not super duper, to put it nicely. But we did some tweaks to it. And we brought the entire staff from Saul. Which, in the interim, when we sort of tried to phase out, we tried to bring them to, you know, phase quietly, close Saul and open new Saul 2.0, whatever you want to call it, without much of an interruption. Of course, it's an opening and it does take time. And we had guys working at Red Gravy and at Vanderbilt and working Brooklyn Bangers at the Brooklyn Flea and doing all that good stuff. So we're able to bring our front of the house people, our back of the house people, the kitchen, the food didn't miss a beat. We added some new players to the team that are intense. I have a great pastry guy from Saul, Guadalupe Garcia, who's worked with me for 13 years, maybe 14 now, but I'm joining him. I have a wonderful, wonderful pastry chef, Joanna Longi, who's amazing. So Lupe and Longi together, making amazing pastry. And we have a Paco Jet for the first time in our entire lives. We have a walk-in freezer that's super, super cold. We have a combi oven, which we never had before, that was there just sitting fallow for years. And, you know, my co-chef de cuisines, Jesse Agravi and Michael Tyler, and I say co-chef de cuisines, and you think they'd be competing, but they're not. They worked beautifully together at Saul, and they have such complementary talents to each other. You know, Michael Tyler, 4 years at La Bernardin, year at Per Se,
chops.
EMP.
Chops.
Technique. Yeah. Jesse Agravi is the soul man. He's got great, great palate, a lot of soul, and he's all about flavor. So you put those two together, and it's a mighty machine. So we've got some great food that's coming out right now in the Brooklyn Museum.
And it's interesting to see. You know, I remember, I mean, things like stadiums and museums were captive audience situations for many, many years, where you had them and you kind of had to feed them, and it became lowest common denominator cooking for the most part. Anyone that's ever been out to the Madison Square Garden or to the old Yankee Stadium would remember, they got you a hostage, you want pizza, great. It comes out of a microwave and it costs $10. F you don't like it. You like beer, it's, you know, $12 garbage. Right. So, but then it's changed. And I think that, I think Danny Meyer has been kind of a pioneer in
City Field,
a bunch of different levels, and MoMA, where suddenly Danny goes into MoMA, and I work out at the athletic club, and I'm a member of MoMA, so I go there, days I have off, I park my bicycle, work at the athletic club in the morning, bicycle down, lock my bike up, do a quick hit at MoMA. And, you know, had Gabrielle there and these amazing kitchens and this sort of completely overlooked market of things like ballparks. I mean, New York's a food town. San Francisco's a food town. Basically, big cities have become food towns. New York, the quintessential food town. Why not have great food in these destinations? How's business been for you at the new spot? Good?
The new spot is good, and we're doing lunch. We've never done lunch before. We're jamming on the lunch. You know, talk to me in a year to really give you an overview of the ups and downs of business and all that kind of stuff. But our old customers are all coming up there, making the trek. We've got parking. The 2-3 stops right there on Eastern Parkway, right in the museum. We have a lot of new customers, neighborhood, people from Manhattan. Obviously, people, tourists, a lot more tourists than we ever had. With that, we have the Jean-Paul Gaultier show right now, exhibition, which is jamming. You have a lot of folks coming through with that. But, you know, it is Brooklyn. As cool as we are at a museum, and it's a challenge. It's definitely a challenge, and there is angst, and, you know, with any opening, there are obstacles to overcome. There's no doubt.
Openings are brutal. How did you find Aisha? Which kitchen was she in with Missy? The Avoce downtown on
Columbus Circle.
Columbus Circle uptown. Okay, yep. I'm sure I've met her, because Missy's just one of these great. I mean, there's so few women in this business. For a whole bunch of reasons, a lot of them are sort of understandable, but few in terms of percentage overall. But I've met so many great women chefs coming up over the years, and I have to tell you, I remember when Missy took over Avoce. So AC had been there after his cafe boulued for years. So here's this guy comes marching from downtown and grabs, I think, 2 or 3 stars from the Times, killed it. The place was busy. It was AC's food.
Immediately.
It was a big hit. It was his coming out party. And then I remember he left, and I sort of dismissed the restaurant as, you know, he's gone. It's his restaurant, man. I mean, I'm not going back. And I think the PR people that were doing it at the time, maybe Bullfrog or Balls, was twisting my arm. I was doing radio, so I kind of had to do stories. Every day I needed stories, so I went, all right, whatever. And I remember going and having her food, just saying, who is this kid? Because even though she's from Connecticut and from around here, in a way, worked in New York, she kind of blew up in Chicago. That's where she trained. And so I'm like, Missy Robbins, never heard of her. And killer food, but work ethic like there's no tomorrow. Missy's the kind of chef, like you, like most chefs I love, that's in there at 8, 9 in the morning, goes to sleep at midnight, a lot of weeks works 7 days a week, has a day off, and just passes out and does laundry. And her kitchen, I remember the kitchen downtown was almost all female, which I thought was so great. Her sous chefs, her line cooks. I think she mentored a lot of women coming up in the business. So how did you find Aisha?
Hoo-wee. It was just a friend of a friend, basically. And Aisha's, it was profound. I mean, she was a career changer. She was a paralegal. And she went, this is a great story. I mean, she went to Philidia, knocked on the door. Hey, I'll work for free. That classic thing.
Yeah.
They said, go away, come back another day. And she kept coming back until they let her start to clean the place. 4 years later, she left as a sous chef. And I can't think of a from watching Lydia on TV, I can't think of a tougher woman on the planet. And I think Lydia had an unbelievable influence on Aisha, who is a tough Brooklyn kid to begin with, like tough, from Bensonhurst. She's a badass. And Lydia imbued even more toughness, even more feeling for food, which Aisha has a passion for anyway, in a deep level, like her mom, her grandmother, yeah. her whole family. Yeah.
It's a great kitchen.
Oh. So, and Missy had a great influence also. I mean, but yeah, it's inspirational. It's so great to I hate to say this, but the youth is so inspirational.
Oh, heck yeah. I don't like hanging around with old people, man. They're boring. People my age are like, leave me alone. You know, most of the kids I hang around with are 35, 30, 20, whatever. I mean, that's where the energy is. And they're and you know it's a young man's game. It's a young gal's game. Oh, yeah. I mean, being in this industry, on the floor as a line cook.
It's a grind.
It's like playing pro sports, man. At some point, your knees are gone. Your feet are gone. You lose a half a step. When I think of how I – there was one point in my career when I was working at the Four Seasons restaurant on Park Ave for lunch. They let me come in early and then leave early, and then I would run over to the Maurice and I worked dinner service with Delouvrier. And I did that for 6 months. Line cook at lunch, line cook at dinner, two different restaurants. I don't know if I slept 5 hours a night.
That's awesome.
It was ridiculous. And I remember thinking, like, I couldn't do that now for a day. You know, but that was the advantage of being 23, 24 years old.
Absolutely. Your body can take it. Your mind can take it. You don't have all the responsibilities that you have now. It's a very different thing. And it's amazing when you're at the age where you can completely immerse yourself and sacrifice every other aspect of your life. Because now that's the balance, is still maintaining that connection, the passion for the food, and being able to inspire your troops and keep in touch with your family, you know.
It's a juggling act, and you've been so successful. Congratulations, Saul. It's great. I haven't seen you in years. Great to have you here at Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network.
It's a pleasure.
No, he's one of the champs. Give us a shout-out. Name your restaurants one more time because we're going to take a spot right after this. Saul's the owner of The Eponymous.
The Eponymous Saul, the Brooklyn Museum, Red Gravy at 151 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, the Vanderbilt at 570 Vanderbilt Avenue on the corner of Bergen and Vanderbilt, and Brooklyn Bangers, which we're selling at the Barclays Center, Yankee Stadium. We'll be selling in the Prudential Center soon. We're pushing that. We have a lot of products that we're working on that getting approved and trying to deliver tasty sausages to the world.
I'm sure you're doing it, brother. Thanks for coming in. Saul Bolton, one of the Brooklyn Pioneers. Great to have you. Pleasure. We're going to take a quick spot, folks, to give a shout-out to a couple of the underwriters that make this show possible and this station possible. And we'll be back with Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg to talk about food and wine pairings and who the hell knows what else we're going to talk about. But we'll never be sure of things. Saul, thanks for coming in so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Hey folks, Mike Alameco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved, used them for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. What is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano. Mike Alameco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters, and I thought, let me start start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about, but a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet, pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
And I'll start out with that correction. All right, folks, we're live again here. We got a new engineer. I'll give him a shout out for a second. Evan? Is that his name? Evan? I got his name. Evan. Got a new engineer this year. So we're breaking people in. But he's a graduate of the New York NYU's something school that has to do with radio and entertainment. And who knows? But welcome aboard, Evan. So Evan and I are trying to get our signals together here. So welcome back. So the show's Food Talk, Michael Lemko's Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. You know that because this isn't a broadcast thing. It's an internet thing. So you've obviously found us on Stitcher or you're live streaming us or you're iTuning us. In any case, welcome back. Saul Bolton was great to talk to. My guests now are guests I've never had on this show because this show's new, but they were kind of frequent guests back when I did Food Talk at WOR. I think I had a day, because that was 6 days a week, so it was a day I kind of devoted to themes, and one day was beverages, and I think it was Fridays, which sucked, because I actually went back to Cape May on Fridays, so I couldn't really drink, and I'd be like, people would come in with like tons of wine and booze and mixology. My engineers loved me, because I'd leave the studio at noon, and I'd be like, guys, take it, I'm not carrying this stuff back home, and I'm sure, you know, while they were playing around with their Adobe and their whatever, putting stuff on Enco and edits, they're basically getting wasted. A lot of early bedtimes for me.
All the perks of radio.
And a shout out to my old engineer, Clint Paul, who's engaged, getting married. He's got a band in the city now, Men in Wales. It's doing great. Yeah. Clint's a good guy. We had tons of fun working together. So welcome, my guest now.
Thank you.
This is by way of a long introduction. Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, welcome.
Great to be here.
You guys.
So happy to be here.
Been a couple for... How many? I don't want to age you.
We just celebrated our 28th anniversary of meeting each other over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend.
Which was so cute. So I don't want to give a shout out for Facebook because I'm a little too old for Facebook, although I'm on it.
We're all too old for
Facebook. As a reluctant participant, but I'm like, you know, I'm part of the AARP group that posts something about once a year, like a picture of a puppy or something, just so no one will look again. But you had this wonderful love post about the night that you met Karen.
Yes. Oh,
you know what?
Andrew surprised me with that.
Tell me the story, because it is so cool. And any couples out there listening,
okay,
it always is kismet. I've always been fascinated by, you know, all of us, depending on what type of personality we're going to plan our lives and, you know, target our trajectory in as much as we can, you know, this
career.
The five-year
plan.
The five-year plan. I'm going to work for this chef.
I had a list of traits in the guy that I was going to marry, none of which Andrew had.
Exactly.
And yet I fell head over heels, so go figure.
No, that's my point. Is that the big stuff always is kismet. The big stuff is always just like fate decides, oh, I'm going to tap you on the shoulder. This is the guy, or this is the job, or this is where you're moving to. And then suddenly a world opens up that wasn't planned. So just for the sentimentalists among us, tell us about the night that you met and how it was arranged.
Okay, I'll give it the start, then Karen will fix it all. I was visiting New York for the very first time with my roommate from Boston. I was living in Boston and working in the restaurant business, very first trip to New York. And we had a mutual friend, because in the day, that's when you could commute between Boston and New York City on Trump Airlines.
People Express.
Yeah,
like
I remember
for
$25
that.
Yeah, yeah, I had to fly to Europe on that.
So we had a mutual friend who lived in Brooklyn, and she would come up and see us in Boston. And we said, oh, we're going to New York. She goes, oh, you can stay in my apartment in Brooklyn and call Karen Page. She's the funnest girl in New York City. So, of course, we're going to make that call. And we made that call about 15 times. And finally got a hold of Karen at work on a Saturday night during Thanksgiving weekend.
And I had been away for Thanksgiving up in Hartford visiting friends of mine from college. And so I came back through my office at that point was Park Avenue South, right very close to Madison Square Garden, Penn Station. So I'd taken the train and I thought, you know, I'm just going to knock out a couple hours worth of work and get ready for Monday morning because I'd been out of town for a while. And so I checked my voicemail and there are these messages from these guys and I didn't know. My friend didn't tell me that she was giving my number to anyone. I'm like,
oh, no.
Who are these
people? So, pull the blinds down.
Indeed. And so we kind of
connected on the phone first, and it's
there.
Sort of like, now who are you? And I said, oh, Robin gave us your number, and she said, you know, this is our first time in New York, this is Andrew's first time in New York, and we just wanted to get together for a drink and hang out, and I just kind of took pity, but I thought, I don't want to hang out with a couple of, you know,
out-of-towners
from
Boston.
Right.
If I show up and these guys have Red Sox hats on, I'm out.
So how would you screen someone?
Back in the day. That's
like, before
Google.
Where are you?
Yes. Right.
And I thought, if they're at like a Bennigan's or something, it's like, I'm not going.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
I'm not going.
Thank you. Yes.
So they said, we're at this club. What is this place called? Oh, it's called the Pyramid Club. It's like, okay, if they're cool enough to make it to the Pyramid Club where I used to dance with my friends on Friday and Saturday nights.
Lower East Side, Avenue B or something. Like funky joint.
Hopkins
it's like,
Square.
Okay, if they're cool enough to make it there, I'll go meet for one drink. It's like, yeah, I'm kind of busy, but yeah, let's have a drink. So anyway, drinks turned into dinner. Mm-hmm. Dinner
here
turned
in Brooklyn.
Into dancing at the Palladium.
Same night.
Yeah.
Same night.
Yep.
Same night.
And the rest is freaking history.
We'll give you the PG version and leave it at that.
No, that's great.
But we've been together ever since that
That's
night.
Great.
Sparks flew.
That's great.
Yes.
Congratulations. And you know, I should also set this up. I brought notes, but of course, I never pay attention to the notes that I bring. I think I do the notes just to get my head ready for the show before the show, and then I ignore them. But you have won James Beard Awards for your writing.
Just two.
Mm-hmm. So two James Beards. What else? And how many books have you guys published?
Oh, God. Okay, now you're challenging our memories. Two James Beard Book Awards. One, the first was for our first book, which was called Becoming a Chef, that came out in 1995. And the most recent one was for the Flavor Bible, which came out in 2008. And then we won the IACP Cookbook of the Year Award.
Great, because that's just industry insiders.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Totally, completely honored to win that for What to Drink with What You Eat.
We're going to stay on that topic
which, by
here.
By the way, also won the George DeBoeuf Wine Book of the Year Award. So they called it a cookbook. No, the same year.
Okay.
They called it a cookbook. They called it a wine book. I don't care what they call it. We're just thrilled that the book won the awards.
Yeah, it's great. I think Kermit Lynch had a book that won the DeBeuf one year. And he's done a lot. I mean, I don't drink his Beaujolais much, but he's done a lot for the region. And speaking of one of my favorite wines now, when I look at restaurant menus now or what I drink at home, I just love Cru Beaujolais. They've had some great vintages since 05. Yeah. They're super food friendly. There's something about them. But talk to me about Food Lover's Guide to Wine and What to Drink with What to Eat or whatever that, because that's a great, that book is almost, I mean, it was a brilliant premise because you sort of have it both ways. First half of the book, it's two halves, and one of them is pairings by wine varietal and weight and style, and then the other half is by food.
Right.
So it just sort of connects everything, and you have snippets from all sorts of top sommeliers, top chefs.
Daniel Ballou.
Yes. Yeah, it's crazy, crazy. Mm-hmm. So talk about that book, and then we'll talk about what you brought in for us to drink
Well,
today.
With What to Drink with What You Eat, you know, this is tis the season because, you know, God love it. It's the book that keeps on going, and it's still in the top five wine books, best-selling wine books in America. And people still put it on their wish lists on Amazon. So it's so nice to see that. So it's made a lot of holiday lists. But I think the reason is because people only want to know so much about wine. You know, they don't always want the in-depth information that we put together in the Food Lover's Guide to Wine. What's the great thing about What to Drink with What You Eat is you can look up just enough about wine. You can know just enough to get just the information you need. And if you don't want to know any more than that, you don't have to. So it'll tell you what to drink with Pad Thai, what to drink with a, God forbid, Hostess Twinkie.
Sauterne? I don't know. What do you mean? Guns N' Roses turkey.
Moscato dusty.
Moscato, you want the bubbles. Okay,
exactly.
All right.
You need the bubbles.
Something to break apart that high fructose corn syrup and the 850 other ingredients that we don't know what they are. Oh, that's funny.
We're happy to take advice on that one.
But I think, but it's a great book because I think your premise is, look, I am, I'm, what am I, 57 now, and been drinking wine since I was a kid, Italian-American. I remember I was drinking wine underage. My grandparents would mix it with water as I was a kid. It was part of the culture. He had like homemade wine in West Philly. And then coming up as a chef in the 70s and 80s, back then most of the good restaurants were French and most of the menus were deep with Burgundy and Bordeaux. So I sort of developed a palate with those. But long story
short,
the long story short is I still drink wine with dinner every night and my budget's like $15 to $25 because it's expensive and I've got kids to support. I'm not a rich guy. And I don't geek out on it. And I'm still learning all the time. I mean, I'm still, I think,
as are we.
The wine world is changing. I'll go into a good store. I live on the Lower East Side now. And I'll go to, like, September Wines on the corner of Ludlow by me. And I'll go in and I'll put my glasses on and I'll spin. And there's these varietals that I've never heard of from Italy, from France. And I'm like, what is this thing? And the guy goes, I think you're going to like it. I know what you like. I think you're going to like it. So
That's the best thing.
All you need to know about wine is you kind of what you like. Pair up what is your palate like. Then find wines that are in that. So your book is a huge aid that way because it, you know, we don't need to know the soil typicity.
You
don't need to know.
No.
All I mean, you can learn that you if you want to.
If you
it's
want.
It's fascinating. Yes. I mean, the world of wine, the more you learn about it, the more fascinated you are, and it pulls you in, and you get excited about trying all these different varieties. And I think we might have spoken to you before about the Wine Century Club, which if you go online and Google it, it's a club for anyone who's tasted more than 100 different wine varieties, which doesn't sound that hard when you think about it in the beginning, but you can get to maybe 40, 50, even 60 pretty quickly, but then beyond that, it starts becoming a challenge to try different ones. And in the case of the, one of the wines we brought today, the grape is a Macabeo, but it's also known as Viura. You can't count it as both because it's the same grape known by two different names, one in Spain and one in France. So that kind of thing, you've kind of got to, you know, over... qualify for something maybe with 110 grapes so that when once they take out the duplicates, you'll hit the 100. But it's a lot of fun. They send you a free certificate suitable for framing, a little test event to put around your neck.
Oh, and, I have to,
you know,
I have to
bragging
think about,
rights.
I'm not sure if I could. I mean, I drink one all the time, and 100's tough because you're when you, like you said, you get to 40 or 50. I mean, so much of, if you're drinking Bordeaux, it's Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Cabernet Franc. You can also be drinking Cabernet Franc from Loire Valley. Doesn't qualify as a different varietal. Exactly. You're drinking Chardonnay from all around the world now. Sauvignon Blanc could be a Bordeaux Blanc, could be a Chardonnay. Again, that's one varietal. That's a million different expressions of it around the planet, but still, you haven't moved up a varietal yet.
Yeah, no, you will be like exploring Portugal, you know, for Trigo Nacional and Spain and all these other places. You typically don't drink wine. And that's the blast of it because, it, you know, again, it's not expensive to do that sort of thing. You can get a lot of great wines, like a Bernarda from Argentina for $15. And that's going to be a great food-friendly wine, you know, for, you know, any of your heavier dishes. But so it's a blast. It was a lot of fun to do.
And speaking of, it's funny you mentioned that because I was in Portugal last year for the first time. And we stayed down south. And I never had that wine before. It was great.
Yeah.
Turicia Nacional. We actually did a little, we actually went to a vineyard where the guy, the winemaker let us blend our own bottle of wine. It was kind of cool. And it was like two teams that he paired off, and they got to be able to blend theirs. And I mean, there's so much good winemaking coming out of from everywhere now.
And I think the less known the area is, the more values are coming out of it. I mean, Champagne is so well known. Everybody's asking us about Champagne.
Value and Champagne? I don't think so.
Time of year. We steer people who are in budgets away from Champagne this time of year and toward other sparkling wines all around the world.
Right.
And I mean, Prosecco is taking off, you know, by leaps and bounds because I think people fell in love with bubbles by drinking Champagne. And they're like, okay, you know, my pocketbook isn't Champagne, but I've got Champagne taste. Where do you point me? And so there's some very good values to be had still in Proseccos and other sparkling wines.
Since we're here and the holidays are upon us, let's stretch out that one out a little bit. I love the from the Languedoc Roussillon, the Cremance that they make, and the you know, they have a couple of different. What's the other bubbly? Because actually, I think the Dom Perignon on his way to Champagne stopped in the south of France, and was it Limoux? There's another one I had, and
Cremant d'Alsace.
Cremant d'Alsace is great.
So good.
Regions wonderful with a great tart flambé. You know, even sparkling sake. I mean, if you've never had sake,
it's
some
great.
People I've called it sort of a chick drink, but I'm a woman. What can I say? I think it's a lot of fun, really delicious.
Cava from Spain,
sure. Oh, I mean, because that is also made in the same method Champenoise as they use in Champagne, as opposed to Prosecco, which is made through the Charmant method, which is sort of a bulk wine tank method.
It's in stainless tanks.
Yes.
If you've been
so
to vineyards.
Just to get...
And there's some good. There's that. What's the one? Is it New Mexico? Gruet.
Gruet. Yeah.
It's
yeah,
crazy. I remember having
really excellent. Good stuff. Very austere. Very clean.
Yeah. Tiny baubles. Yeah. Not a big yeasty
and
nose.
Really reasonable. And actually, they may also. Make a huge variety. I would say go on to winesearcher.com because
winesearcher.com
and you can find it. And but they also make a sweeter style wine, a sparkler that doesn't always make it out here but could be shipped, that sort of thing. So Gruet is great. I think really one of your house wines needs to be right now is a sparkling rosé. And it doesn't matter where it's from, but it's just so food friendly. You can get them for 15 or less. You can always spend more, of course. I mean, if you want to get a beautiful sparkling rosé, look to Iron Horse. They make incredible sparkling rosé.
And that's your anniversary. That's what you poured at your wedding, if I'm not mistaken.
We did.
So I remember
Iron
that.
Horse wedding cuvée.
Wedding cuvée was at our wedding, yes.
But, you know, I think a rosé will take you from appetizers all the way through, you know, some lighter entrees and even into cheese or dessert. So, again, it's just a great – you should have it in your house all the time, but it's just a great one to have on hand for the holidays.
And from California, is it Schaffenberger's, an old house that does good champagne?
Absolutely.
They're
excellent.
There's some – and is there – are there any from upstate New York?
Sure. Well, if you go to the Finger Lakes, you can get from Constantin Frank.
Right, that's
Celeb.
The label.
Yeah.
It's a sparkling Riesling. And so there are drier versions and sweeter versions that I adore them all.
And I've always been a proponent, or for some time now I've been a proponent, of trying to get people, instead of just drinking sparkling wines or champagne in specific, but sparkling wines around the holidays and before meals, to David's point, drink it with food. Because if you think about champagne.
Yes.
What are the two grapes in champagne? Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Maybe the two greatest grapes on the planet.
Yeah,
so,
I think you can find something more versatile.
Yes, thank you. So do we have food friendly going on here? And you can have a different blend of it, from Brut to not so Brut to Rosé, where you're going to have a little color and a little tannin. And then you think of foods from fried foods.
Absolutely.
To dried meats to salumi to cheeses, where you want bubbles anyway.
Right.
Lighter meats, seafood. I mean, champagne, I drink champagne.
Even sushi. It's
sushi,
fabulous.
Fantastic
sushi.
With sushi.
Yeah.
Drink it with...
Kills with Asian food.
Yeah, drink it before the meal and with the meal and throughout the whole thing. It's great.
Couldn't agree more. Always in our house.
Yeah, so we actually brought one bubbly tonight. And you know,
so tell me what you have here. What's in this
one? One really esoteric and one kind of one that we thought that everybody can find. So they have it at Sherry Lehman. It's the Rosa Regal Brachetto d'Acqui.
I know,
so
this wine.
This is a great wine. It's not it's not terribly expensive. I don't want me to say what other people would consider expensive. It's $12. In the range of 12, 13 bucks.
It's hard to find anything drinkable under that. I mean, that's kind of the bottom.
It's sweet, red, sparkling. I mean, that says holidays to me. what's beautiful about it, it's versatile enough. You can serve it for brunch around the holidays. You can serve it as a dessert, just like, you know, in a champagne flute.
Has a light tint to it, kind of a rose color.
A little strawberry note, raspberry.
Right, big strawberry note.
It plays up against fruit. It plays up against chocolate beautifully. I mean, I love it. It's incredibly refreshing. And just like Moscato Dusty, which I mentioned previously, it's so versatile at dessert time. I think this, for people who love Moscato, they're like, well, what else do you think I'd like? And it's like, okay, well, have you tried Brachetto? And no, they run out and they get it.
It's light and it's refreshing, so it is nice at dessert also for that reason alone. It's like if someone's going to pour me Sauternes or vintage port, I'm going to say absolutely thank you, more please. But if you want something just sort of light and fun, sending it off with a smile, that's a great little bottle.
And they
of wine.
Have it everywhere, so
yes.
You don't have to be frustrated that you can't find it.
Yeah, you don't need Wine Searcher for that.
Rosa Regale, and Sherry Lehman, and better wine stores everywhere.
They everywhere has them. And this other one that's more esoteric with this
it
funky little top on it.
For the first time. And we can't get over it.
Is it in this glass?
Yeah. This is a Rivesol Ambré. So the Rivesol, it's a vin du naturel. It's a natural sweet wine. So the grapes are picked late. And the Ambré, it's sort of an amber color. This is Héritage du Temps. It's from Singla, Singla. And this is a 2005 vintage, which I think is much friendlier than the last vintage of 2003, which was very hot. But this is $56, so it's a special occasion. But you don't need a lot, just like a little dessert, glass of dessert wine, which is maybe an ounce or two or three tops. You can have it with nuts. You can have it with cheese. You can have it with chocolate desserts. It's got some oxidized.
Yeah, I was
going to
say it's slightly Madeirized.
Yeah.
So that's so. Tell me
but
about the style.
It's not as heavy as sherry.
No, I think it's a very. It sort of reminds me of Oloroso, a lighter PX sherry. So the nutty Oloroso, the sort of the raisiny PX sherry. So what's cool is this is from Languedoc-Roussillon. So what's funny about this wine is it's right across the border from Spain. Now, here's a sentence I've always wanted to say. So, Mike, when we saw you in the south of France...
oh, by the way.
Right, yes.
Wasn't
that
hysterical?
Yeah.
I forgot about that. That was
we
at the jazz festival.
Yes. At the jazz so, festival.
So, Gerard Bertrand.
Gerard Bertrand. Exactly.
Oh, this charismatic, gorgeous, yes. Big, 6'3", ex-rugby
oh, you
yeah. player.
Too, huh?
No, Gerard, yeah. And he's such an advocate, because his dad was a vigneron, I believe. And his dad passed young. And he had this full-on rugby career and decided to go into the family vineyards and has just thrown his energy into...
And we see his wines everywhere. A lot of them are very accessibly priced, but great distribution. You can find them.
Yeah, and he's got bio. A lot of organic. Yeah. I think all of his vineyards are organic.
And actually, this one we have here is biodynamic also. But what's fun about it in that region is when we were down there, we were served paella. We're like, we're in France. We're getting paella. And they're like, well, yeah. It's like, well, you know, Spain is just a few kilometers away.
They have bullfights in that part of France. Yes. Bullfighting is huge in that part of France.
When I tasted it, I'm like, I expected one thing and got entirely another. But I think this is an incredibly food-friendly wine. It's 16% alcohol. So... lower than a lot of cabs, unfortunately, these days.
You don't want to drive home to Cape May afterwards.
No.
But I think it's a fun wine. I think it would pair really good with chocolate and hazelnuts, chocolate and pecans, any sort of nutty thing.
And we did bring some chocolate.
We have some lilac chocolate, so you can compare.
Test the theories.
Yes. But it's just a fun, interesting wine. And I think what's fun about the holidays is it's an opportunity to try something new. Break out of the rut. Bring a different sparkle. If you're at a party and there's going to be 12 different bottles, you know, everyone's bringing something different. Well, bring something different and really have some fun and then talk to your friends over it and say, what do you think? What do you think? Go back and forth while you're trying it and try some food
with it. So give me the label again so we can have listeners who are curious as to what we're
Absolutely.
Talking about find it on winesearcher.com or whatever they're going to use in the Google search.
Sure. Mm-hmm. It's the 2005 Singla, Singla, Rivesaltes, that's spelled Rivesaltes, love the French, Ambre, Ambre, Heritage, Heritage, Dutemps.
Which means who knows what, but you've got to love the French labels. You need a decoder ring to figure it out.
Right,
But this part of France, the Languedoc-Roussillon, for a while I actually worked for their... they opened up a New York Maison, and I was kind of a food part of it, but I discovered the region from traveling there, love the wines. And have been able to travel pretty extensively around there. And right around where this is from is where Bonneuil's comes from, which is another fantastic dessert wine.
Yes. Like one of the peak pairings with chocolate.
I think it's my
you're
favorite.
You're a chocolate fan, and you think chocolate can't taste any better than chocolate, chocolate and Bonneuil's,
yes.
even better.
And there's another grape that's also in Languedoc-Roussillon, but it's further. Bonneuil sits right on the water. I don't even know how they harvest it. The slopes are... Mm-hmm. We filmed there once, and I was worried about everyone dying, myself included.
Yes.
There's another one called Maury, Maury, that's from up in the Peel. But in that same region, it's
very
another
similar,
chocolate pairing.
Yes. Very delicious.
So, if you're thinking for the holidays, if you're having chocolate-based desserts, and you'd want to get past the boring, you know, port or sauterne pairings, go for Bonneuil's. Go for this.
Bonneuil's.
I'm sorry, I assume that. Bonneuil's. Mm-hmm. Superb wines. And this other one that somebody mispronounced called Maury or something like
M-A-U-R-Y.
That. M-A-U-R-Y. I know how to spell it. M-A-U-R-Y. Kind of esoteric. And as you said, I think it'll kind of, unless your friends are wine geeks, people are going to be like, what is this stuff?
Actually, the person who turned us on to Bonneuil's the first time was Jean-Luc Ledoux at Danielle. We're having this chocolate dessert. And he pours us, we're like, Bonneuil's. So if you do need to research one, go check out Ledoux Wines. That's my guy. So
yeah, Jean-Luc was on the floor. Jean-Luc's an amazing guy. Here's this French guy, completely French. Still has a French accent. He's been in America forever. Has a little goatee. Loves me.
Rock and roll lover.
Dude, I bumped him at Wilco one day. Yo, dude, what are you? I'm like, what do you mean? What I'm doing? Nels Klein, my favorite guitar. You know, like,
it's Wilco.
It's Wilco. Of course, I wouldn't miss this. And so, but Jean-Luc's funny because he came from France to the States. Didn't really know much about wine at all, was living in Queens, and was dating a girl, an American girl, whose dad introduced him to who knows what. Like, they went out to dinner at his dad's house or something, and his dad opened up, like, a Petrus or Cheval Blanc or one of these, you know, first growth.
So Jean-Luc made a good first impression, apparently.
No, it was the other way around.
Right.
Jean-Luc
Jean-Luc got first impression.
Jean-Luc got turned on wine by his American girl.
We actually told that story in Dining Out, 1998.
It's hysterical.
Third book.
Because everyone that knows Jean-Luc now has figured he was born and raised in a vineyard and grew up as a...
He thinks that of all the French guys, like Michel Cuvreau at Per Se. You know, he got his start and he told his parents, you know, I'm going to go become a sommelier. They said, what's that? I mean, he's from France, but he's from I think it's Normandy.
Yeah,
they drink cider. They don't, it's not a wine town. Yeah. So lo and behold.
Calvados and cider.
Yeah.
So give us a shout out for your books again. My guests have been Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, husband and wife team, 20-some books together, Two Beards, an IACP award.
And a par- Partridge in a Pear Tree.
Partridge in a Pear Tree, the books sell. And if you're thinking of holiday books for the holidays for your friends that want to get to know more about wine or want to increase their wine knowledge, the last two.
The most recent. What to Drink with What You Eat is huge this time of year. And then the Flavor Bible, of course, if you're looking to come up with new dishes, new cocktails, new cupcakes, it's all there for you. And next year we'll have the Vegetarian Flavor Bible.
I know, I saw that in the pipeline. We'll have you on before that a couple of times, I'm sure. Thanks for coming
on. Awesome, anytime.
Sure.
It's great always our pleasure, you. Mike. You're the best.
Thank you, guys. Please, we've got to wind down the show. It's an hour, and they pull the plug on me after an hour. They throw pizzas at me. It's been great to do another edition of Michael Michael's Food Talk here from Heritage Radio Network, Bushwick, Brooklyn, the Morgan stop on the L train with Christmas trees for sale on Bogart Street. It's that time of year. We'll do a couple more shows before the holidays. We'll figure out what we can do around Christmas. I'll keep you all posted. But folks, take care. Be well. See you next week. We'll be back. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.